Okay, Generative Energy, number 87 with Georgi Dinkov, fresh back from Bulgaria. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, fine. You know, feeling as rebellious as ever.
Okay, and you said you had
it's good to change the environment a little bit, you know, just to see the United States from the outside.
So you
had, so and that, I had a brush with the authorities, so to speak. And I can tell you, you know, as far as the government services are concerned, they really are making no secret of the fact that they are treating us as slaves, as people that basically don't matter. My daughter's passport expired, her U.S. passport, because she was born here, so she's a U.S. citizen. So it expired, and then, you know, we got to Bulgaria, and we realized that it has expired. She also has a Bulgarian one, so that's why she was able to travel. And then I tried to apply for a passport renewal at the U.S. Embassy. Maybe it's just a case, maybe that's just how the U.S. Embassy operates in Bulgaria, but since then I've spoken to other people who've had similar experiences. Bottom line is this, you cannot call the U.S. Embassy in Bulgaria anymore. Like even if it's a dire emergency, you cannot get anybody on the phone other than an operator, and the operator will ask, tell me the extension of the person you're trying to reach. And if you don't have the extension, they hang up on you. So everything is an entirely automated system. And basically, you just listen to pre-recorded messages. The only way to get in touch with the embassy is through an email. And I don't need to tell you that sending them an email takes a couple of days for them to even respond. And then basically, like, they respond with the same boilerplate over and over, maybe because each time you send an email, a new person reads it, and then they send you the same boilerplate. Now, people say, well, that's just, you know, regular bureaucracy. That was not the case, as recently as 2019. Especially considering that this is service for U.S. citizen, right? I can understand that peons like me, who I'm not a U.S. citizen, I just have a green card, I can understand getting treated as a slave. But like the service, quote unquote, or lack thereof that we got for a U.S. citizen is abysmal. So it took me 2 weeks just to schedule an appointment for my daughter to submit the application for a new passport. Initially, they were refusing to even meet us. They were saying, well, what's her emergency? Well, the emergency that she needs to come back to the U.S. and start school. Well, that's not an emergency. Really? Before even we get to that, there is a page on the State Department and on the embassy which says if the passport is less than 1 year expired and you have it in your possession, the U.S. citizen is allowed to return to the U.S. with that passport. Of course, I quote that article and that page from the Department of State and from the U.S. embassy, and I get a response back saying that's no longer valid. Really? So why is this on your page? Well, you shouldn't be pointing out errors in our systems. You are the one who are guilty. I mean, kid you not, that's basically like the response that I got back, saying like, why are you quoting our website? How dare you, right? And I said, okay, so what's the procedure? Well, the procedure is that you have to wait a month, and then you have to come in person with both parents physically present in order to submit a new passport application. I'm like, forget it. One parent is not even in Bulgaria. The other parent, the mother is in the U.S., Well, it's a complicated situation. How complicated can it be? Like, what is it that we need to do? Well, we need an original of the birth certificate. We need a notarized document from the mother approving this new application for a passport. We need all of your documentation, copies and everything, et cetera, et cetera. We need a picture taken of the child. And you need to present proof showing, because the passport was done when she was a baby, right? And now she's 6 years old. You need to show us pictures, at least 20 from each year, demonstrating the progress of physical changes in the child's facial appearance. I mean, like, just think of all this. Okay, anyways, we gather all this documentation. We go there, and then they start saying, I don't like this notarized document. Like, basically, the notary here, we cannot read her handwriting. It doesn't matter. It's a notary. She has her contact information. Well, she scratched something here, and then she used the whiteout on top of it, and we cannot accept the document. So they basically said, we cannot accept this one document, and because of that, the entire application is rejected. Go back. Start from scratch. So same thing. We had to do this three times just to get everything in order, and eventually we get to the embassy, and basically they're saying, look, we operate with no more than 25% of our staff. Like, we don't even handle passport applications anymore. Now we send them all of them are going back to the U.S. and you have to wait for the passport to arrive from the U.S. Well, I mean, I'm like, okay, so it's an emergency. Like, it's not an emergency. Well, what's your emergency? I mean, what do you consider emergency? Well, only if somebody's dying. Okay, so if the child has to go back to school, and if she doesn't go back, if that's if the DC public schools treat this as a missing child situation, that's not an emergency to you. They're like, no, but it is to you. I'm a kid. That's literally how they treat us. So what are we doing now? Well, we're gonna send the application back to the U.S. The State Department may or may not, approve the application, even though the embassy already did, right? And then they're gonna take their sweet time, and eventually maybe they will issue the passport. And until that time, the child is stuck in Bulgaria. So my daughter is still in Bulgaria. So I have to, if the passport does arrive, and I don't know when it will arrive, I have to go back and pick her up. So an extra flight, an extra several thousand dollars out of pocket just to go and pick up my child, because the general attitude was that you don't matter. Like, why are you wasting our time? Like, what are you doing here? Well, I have an expired passport. And there was like, well, why does this child need to travel? Because her grandparents are in the country. Yeah, but, don't you know there's a pandemic? Since 2019, we've been kind of encouraging people not to travel. I'm like, so what are you saying? That, it's a bad thing that we travel? Like, yeah. Why did you travel? That's pretty much the attitude that we got. Why did you travel? Why you put yourself into the situation by traveling? We've been discouraging people from traveling. We here no longer have, like, we only have 25% of our staff of what we used to have. We fired everybody. And we basically only exist here for God knows what reason, but definitely not serving U.S. citizens and issuing passports and helping them out. So they said, our honest advice is do not travel anymore, especially with small children.
Man, that is so wild that you have to go back. And how long is that flight?
Well, 8 to 10 hours from here to Western Europe, and then there's a transfer flight, and then another two, 3 hours from Western Europe to Bulgaria.
Something somebody said that's probably obvious, but I haven't really thought about is, like, how they were so effective at saying, don't go out. If you go out during a lockdown, you're like killing people. Like, they're clearly going to use that same strategy for the climate stuff.
Oh, like, yeah. Just by breathing, you're killing somebody, Danny. Don't you know it? You're producing CO2, and somebody right now is dying because you're breathing.
but also, you're using your air conditioner during blackouts. You're killing people. We only have this much energy or whatever. And obviously that would happen, but I guess I just haven't thought about it, that they will easily turn people against each other, just like they did with the COVID stuff, and how effective that was. Like, I don't know if I remember talking about it on here, but I remember being at an art exhibit and the woman's husband was there, and he must have said every single talking point that was on the news that I was like killing people by not being vaccinated and I should be wearing a mask at all time. And it was just it was terrifying that idea is going to be progressed even more intensely in the future.
Like I said, get ready for war. I don't think there's any avoiding it. and I don't know which one will be worse, World War III or us, getting at each other's throats. Because one way or the other, there's no way. Remember that Ray quote when somebody sent him something about like people being oppressed? And he said, wow, basically like if everybody is traumatized, there's nobody left who is non-traumatized. So traumatized people cannot diffuse their trauma through others, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no let out. There's no channel for us to channel our trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So the only thing that can happen is basically we grab knives or forks or whatnot, and we turn on each other. I mean, it's already, I would say we're already there, like in a soft way, right? It's like a soft civil war. Yeah. Just the way the government is treating people, I personally experienced it. I guess most people are not, because they, not many people get into the situation. But once you get more to the periphery, like you have every opportunity to see how little the government cares about you. And I can tell you personally that was not that way, or at least I didn't get that vibe. Like as recently as 2019, when we still, I still went back to Bulgaria, we still had to deal with the embassy, and they were like very polite, very, they reached out. They were actually calling us, saying, hey, how are the children doing? The U.S. citizens, you peons, you can go to hell, but how are the U.S. citizens doing? And now, nope, you cannot even call the embassy. I don't even know why they have a phone number, just to play some pre-recorded messages. So yeah,
well, I did.
I think the process of deglobalization is in high gear, or at the very least, separation of the hemispheres of influence. Like basically, and until I guess the powers, until the big powers duke it out, essentially, they want people under control, not traveling, staying hyper-local, right, under control, not consuming many resources. And that's the message that I got directly from the embassy people. They were saying, if we were you with two small children, we would not leave the city, let alone the country.
I did ask Ray if he wanted to come on and we would do like a prepper episode. And he sent me back something I wasn't really expecting. But he's basically saying that prepping and like the family farm were examples of American deluded individualism. And I asked for clarification on his response. And I was like, for whatever's happening. Well, not only did individualism get us into this type of mess, but like allowing the powers that be to kind of like control everybody, but also that whatever like a person's hope for survival in the future would depend on some kind of community. And he replied, I think so. And so.
Yeah, but I'm kind of getting confused by his, but I'm not confused, but like, okay, the solutions that he proposes, and he keeps saying we need to organize, right? He would try to organize it with traumatized people. They're not exactly interested in actually listening or hearing or doing anything.
I actually mentioned that to him in the email. I was like, well, my so far the organization stuff has not been successful. And if anything has traumatized me, it spooked me a little bit about getting too close to people. So
exactly. Yeah. So I mean, I think I hear his point about like individualism, right? It's definitely not the time not now to be divided. But every time I've tried to reach out and basically like try to do something as a group effort with other people, and by the way, I'm getting the same emails from other people who have tried to do the prepping thing in groups outside of the system, right? And their experience was the exact same. They're saying like nobody really trusts anybody right now. And it's like everybody's so amped up and so angry about things that, you know, like at the slightest disagreement, we're actually ready to kill each other. So it's like, I don't think right now is the best time to actually organize simply because people are not in the position to actually put aside their differences and try to look forward towards something, you know, something bigger than themselves. Right now, it's all about like, you know, things are about to get really rough. I wouldn't even know. We don't even know if we'll survive. I think we have to get beyond that point for people to basically like let down their, you know, self-preservation instinct and say, okay, so we survived. What do we do from now on?
I think you're completely right. You're onto something. Okay. Before we get into articles, and we haven't talked for like probably over a month. Is there any other topics you wanted to address?
I don't know. I mean, I keep getting sent these articles that basically the DC will make like the COVID vaccine mandatory or they'll kick children out of school. Mm-hmm. I mean, so far I haven't seen any evidence for that. They the way the press is wording it is that the vaccine is mandatory or your children will get kicked out of school. But what they're not telling you is that all the government is doing is basically adding the vaccine to the schedule of the other already required vaccines. You still have, so far, and I'm saying so far because there's some forces trying to remove that. You still have the exemptions, the philosophical and medical exemptions, which, you know, like many people have taken advantage of. So far, DC has not removed that. Whether that will, you know, remain as an option, I don't know. Remains to be seen. I so far have not seen. And a court just struck down the requirement for DC government workers to be vaccinated. So I think the courts have more or less like put a, you know, have kind of put a stop to this whole like mandatory vaccination kind of thing. Doesn't mean that the mayor, who doesn't hide her sympathies for the World Economic Forum and the rest of the ilk, it doesn't mean that the mayor is not going to try to come up with something else. I personally don't think it will happen simply because like that articles that I keep getting sent says that basically 60% of the black children in DC are unvaccinated. Those are the core constituents or the parents, at least, of these children are the core constituents that elected the mayor. So unless it gets to real hardcore, like military martial law kind of situation, I don't see the mayor actually trying to enforce the vaccines, because she does, that means the majority, because DC is still like the majority of the children are African Americans, the majority of the schools will be empty. So I don't know what will happen. Basically, there'll be riots from the African American families, because if these kids get kicked out of school, clearly most of these people cannot afford private schools. And by the way, the private schools will probably have the same requirement. So I unless the mayor is looking at like full civil war localized to DC, I don't think this is going to happen anytime soon. But we'll see.
And then going into winter, do you think there's what do you think is going to happen?
I don't know that much will happen in D.C. I definitely think the situation is dire in Europe. I mean, you can, you know, at least in Bulgaria, there's no illusion. Everybody knows that basically they're out. They're on their own. Everybody's gathering firewood from the forest and like in, you know, any other places that they can, you know, get their hands on. The government is basically also not really lying anymore, saying like, look, there will be blackouts, there will be water shortages. Basically, don't count on electricity being on for more than 3 to 4 hours a day. If that, there may be even situations where you're going to have like multiple days without electricity. And basically people are now turning into, you know, salt and curing food, because if you have, even if you have a refrigerator, after 2 or 3 days without electricity, you know, forget about all that preserved food you had. So they're doing like things like they're putting things in jars and boiling them up, which is something that Bulgarians have always done, but now it's basically in high gear. So again, I'm kind of grateful for going out of the system and kind of going to the periphery and seeing how things really are for the people that don't have the illusion of normality, the normalcy bias. Nobody has any illusions. Basically, they're saying like we are in a soft World War III. The only question is whether nukes are going to start flying or not. And then this winter, they kind of expect the European Union to be several of the big EU countries to have large scale riots. And basically, the discussions right now are whether the EU will survive the winter or not, because several countries, you know, the probably most notable example will be Hungary, but also Serbia. Serbia is not an EU member, but still Hungary is EU member and has struck deals with Russia. And basically Hungary is energetically fine. And other EU countries that are basically supporting Ukraine, their citizens are saying, what the hell? How can Ukraine be like getting like full energetic? I mean, all of their energy needs will be covered, right? And we here are suffering for what? I mean, basically they're not supporting Russia. They're staying neutral. Why can't we stay neutral? So, I don't know if you've seen the news, but like the UK already has the highest inflation on record. They're expecting 3/4 of the small businesses and especially the pubs to actually close down for good. I don't know if it's deliberate or not. Some people say, well, that's exactly what the Great Reset is all about. What is deliberate or not, I'm not sure, because I think the powers that be will try to avoid full-scale civil war / riots, right, at a national level. But it looks like this is where it's going this winter. Germany, I don't know if you've seen the articles on Zero Hedge, but I also had the opportunity to speak to some people in Bulgaria who have business in Germany and some Germans who live in Bulgaria, expats. Basically, there's been a huge influx of German expats from Germany into Bulgaria because they expect things to get really nasty this winter. And some people think that it may be a repeat of 1939. Basically, there'll be a martial law because the government is kind of it's not really fully open with the citizens saying like, well, look, there'll be, you know, we won't have enough food and not enough energy to survive. But that's the mood on the street. And people are, you know, those who can afford it are trying to get out of that center of the chaos, which I think will be focused on UK, Germany, France, Belgium, Netherlands, truly like the core of the EU. Okay, UK is no longer in the EU, but still, you know, Western Europe will probably burn this winter, not figuratively. Figuratively, not literally, because they don't have the firewood and the coal to burn. But things will get nasty, and then if that doesn't ignite World War III, we're probably looking at some sort of a breakdown of the EU by early spring because, many reasons. Several of the countries are really in a really poor financial shape. Actually, the entire EU is. But now with the energetic crisis destroying the German economy, which is truly the engine of the EU, without the German economy, the EU disappears overnight. And now Germany is admitting publicly, saying like, well, look, half of our industry may be gone by March, April. I just don't see how the European Union can survive. Unless, of course, they declare martial law and then go full on fascism, which will probably be a dry run for what they're planning for the rest of the world, especially the U.S.
It will be interesting to see if those like the rationing will necessitate the digital ID and how they'll work in vaccines to that. Like, we had always postulated that the vaccine passports would arise first and that would lead to a digital ID and not that there would be power outages or whatever, but that seems more.
I think the rationing right, will be like a very, very great opportunity for the powers that be to introduce the digital currency, or at least the digital ID. They'll say, okay, no digital currency, but we're going to have this digital ID for you, right? And that's what you're going to use, you know, to get the rations, the food rations.
Didn't Sri Lanka?
And once, of course, you get that, right, once it's implemented and everybody has it, then it will be done in a way that you can, of course, you can upgrade it and you can load a lot of many other things on it, right? So once this becomes mandated for whatever reason, maybe, you know, it will start as, you know, as to get your food rations. After that, I don't think there's any going back. I mean, basically, once it becomes used for things such as, you know, rationing of food, everything else is probably of secondary importance. It will be accepted much more easily, right?
I guess Sri Lanka is already doing this. And so that's clearly some kind of test bed for later. Exciting times. Looking forward to the future. Okay. What? Any of these?
Honestly, I think the elite is done. I think all of this is basically is peanuts. It's nothing. There, one way or another, there will be world war. I don't know who will start it, where it will start. There's just no way out of this. And I know Ray keeps saying, like, well, if they implement a digital ID and the currency, et cetera, then of course, then they can have their, like, you know, technocratic, nightmarish, brave new world. I don't think it will work. The West is bankrupt. It just doesn't work that way. The West still needs fuel, still needs food. It still needs many other things that are needed to run this technocratic world. So unless China and Russia are fully on board with that, I think the West is done.
Looking forward to seeing what happens.
Okay. I mean, if anybody has any idea of how the West can emerge out of this, considering that they're banking their future on this advanced technology, all of which gets currently made in Taiwan, and the China is about to take over and appropriate that island, which is theirs, by the way, right? But you know the company TSMC?
Mm-mm.
Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It produces 90% of the chips, of the computer chips, are basically in your phone, in the computer that you use, et cetera, et cetera. They produce 90% of those chips worldwide. So you know, if that company somehow gets into the Chinese hands, then basically it's game over. The U.S. anybody around the world whose economy is dependent on advanced technology is finished, because, or at the very least, a slave or a vassal to China. I mean, there's just no way out of it. Of course, there's talks about onshoring this right now, basically like bringing back the production of chips. I think Intel is trying to build a big factory in Arizona to basically go back to what they used to do in the 90s, late 90s, all the way up to the late 90s, actually, produce the chips here in the United States. But it's going to take 5 to 10 years. And that's the most optimistic forecast. So, again, if the way things are going, if the EU breaks down, the economies are so interconnected, I don't see how EU can fall apart without the U.S., you know, falling into, like, deep depression, if not outward economic collapse. And even if they implement full fascism, still that doesn't resolve the issue of resources. Like without energy, no country can survive. And without food, as Vladimir Lenin used to say, even the most advanced society is only 3 meals away from chaos. Now, I think U.S. produces a significant amount of food and they even export a lot of it to China. But still, without energy, maybe some states like Texas, I don't know, maybe Florida, states that are more Oklahoma, states that are energetically independent, they can take care of themselves with fossil fuels, maybe they'll be okay. But the country as a whole does not currently have a viable energy policy if fossil fuels are basically off the books. If fossil fuels are back, then it's a different story. But one way or another, I just don't see a way out of this. And I've spoken to several analysts at think tanks and whatnot, and they're basically slowly coming to the same conclusion that basically the only way the West sees out of this is through war. Basically, you know, fighting Russia or fighting China, you know, and basically it's a war for survival. I mean, I'll send you some articles in the press, and of course all of them are war mongers. But like the message in those articles are basically slowly starting to converge towards the same idea. We collectively, we, the West, are screwed. The only way for us to survive is actually fight these people that actually have the resources and take them away from us. Back in the day, in the 17, 1800s, was the situation was, well, wouldn't it be nice if we conquer Russia and China and whatnot and get all of their resources? Now is, if we don't get these resources by force, we finished.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. That, I mean, that does sound like a compelling hypothesis of what would happen. If the U.S. can't sustain itself, even though they wouldn't mind if a lot of the population died or didn't have food, or if they destroyed those legacy systems, the whole thing would not be sustainable in general. But aren't these people that are running things internationalists? And so they don't necessarily care about the U.S. per se. They just care about ruling the world.
Yeah, but you still need the infrastructure and everything else on which this digital fascism depends. As much as it's about control, it itself is very vulnerable. You basically need constant and steady supply of electricity. You need things working. You don't want marauding gangs running around and killing each other and potentially destroying a lot of that infrastructure in the process too. So somehow, to me, the whole I can see the planned collapse thing, right? But that only works if you have full access to the resources, and then you're basically deliberately restricting access to those resources for the regular people, right? And you're slowly killing them, or at least turning them into slaves, and basically saying, okay, now if you want to eat, you're gonna have to have this digital ID and vaccine and whatnot, and then I'll give you something to eat. But if there's no energy, and the way currently things are, at least for Europe. Multiple countries came out and said there is no alternative to Russian energy. Maybe in 20 years, maybe in 10 years, right? Currently, if we do not strike a deal with Russia within the next, it's already late. People will die out of starvation and cold. But if we don't strike a deal with Russia in the next few months, Europe collectively is finished. It's just not possible to maintain Europe in its current state without access to Russian energetic sources. So, behind the scenes, what you're already seeing, and the press is starting to acknowledge that, is that behind the scenes, there's this mad dashing back and forth trying to strike deals with Russia and avoid the sanctions. Basically, I think what they caught already, Netherlands, Germany, and even the UK, by basically taking Russian ships, intercepting them into the middle of the sea, of course, with the full knowledge of the Russians, then transferring the resources to other Western-owned ships, and then taking the whole thing back to port as if it didn't come from Russia. But one way or another, Russia is calling the shots for Europe. And then as far as the U.S. is concerned, again, highly advanced, quote-unquote, technological economy. All of it depends on chips. All of it depends on steady access to resources so you can produce energy. If these things are not available, I just don't know how the international elite would be able to maintain its power. All of that depends. It's basically subject to access to resources, right? And then currently the control of these resources is not in the United States. It's not in the West. The Saudi Arabia has already sided with Russia and with China. They're already starting to trade their oil in rubles and yuans, right? And then I just don't see, again, U.S. has some energy independence if it goes back to fossil fuels. Europe doesn't. There's not nothing Europe can do other than import fuels from Russia in order to survive. There may be a path for energy independence, maybe if they revive nuclear, right? But still, it's going to take years in order for that to happen. So I don't know. Either we're going to see some very quick armistice and basically somehow West declaring victory, even though it will be a complete disaster and actually in a rout, or we see some large scale war with Russia direct. There's no other option. The Russians are saying it. They've been saying, if you actually read the Russian press, they've been saying this for months. It's basically saying that West has shot itself not only in the foot, but in the lungs with its current policy of sanctions and alienating Russia, to the point where Russia is now saying, "You know what? We don't need you. Okay, we're gonna go with the Chinese. We're gonna go with the Arabs. We're gonna go with the Indians. We're gonna go with the Brazilians. We're gonna go with Latin America. We don't need Europe. You need us." And now Europe is saying, yes, okay, the people are going to starve, okay? But even, it's not just the people are going to starve. Europe cannot survive, cannot keep the lights on unless they get access, immediate access, restoration of access to Russian energy resources, which is mostly fossil fuels.
Several countries now are issuing things to their citizens about like preparing for things to get bad. I think Poland did it and maybe some other places I can't remember, but...
Yeah, but this is all token. I mean, this is not going to save the majority of the people. Basically, if the electricity goes out, especially in central and northern European countries, if basically you get like, I don't know, Germany, okay, northern parts of Germany, or northern parts of Poland, or the Baltic republics, which are members of NATO right now, it can get pretty brutally cold there, right? If the lights go out in Latvia or Estonia for, let's say, 2 or 3 days in the middle of January, you will see mass casualties. Mm-hmm. And what's worse, the system will not be able to handle those mass casualties. So you basically have large-scale collapse of society. I don't think the elite wants that. I mean, like, I can see the elite wanting gradual culling of the population, but still has to be kept under control. Remember, when things really get ugly, anybody is a potential target, even the elite. I know some of them went like, I don't remember, like in early 2021, like there was like a mass resignation of like the big CEOs of tech companies. Yeah. The Google founders disappeared. I mean, they didn't disappear. They went to they have several islands, but I think they're currently based in an island in the Caribbeans. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bill Gates resigned from the Microsoft board of directors. Who else? I think Jack Dorsey, the Twitter guy, also is also gone.
Disney, like a bunch. It was like 20 or 30 or maybe even more high profile CEOs all left at the exact same time.
Yeah, didn't Zuckerberg also resign? Like I think he's still on the board, but I don't. Is he still CEO of Facebook?
I can't recall.
Or did he say he's going to resign or something?
I can't recall, but I remember a lot at the same time.
Bezos resigned. Mm-hmm. Bezos is no longer the CEO of Amazon. Mm-hmm. So all of these things happened in early 2021. Okay, so these people they think they're taken care of. They'll go to a Caribbean island. Maybe they have like a full energy, like an electricity production system, you know, completely independent. Okay, so they will be okay. But again, in a large-scale collapse of society, all of your currency loses its value. What are these people, how are they going to maintain their power with what? Like with access to what, right? I mean, all of this, they're only billionaires on paper, remember, right? No law in no country, these people become peons just like us. So I suspect that there's been basically a collective, like a case of really suicidal collective idiotism in the Western political elite. And basically they thought that Russia would collapse, they thought the sanctions would work, right? And now that all of this has not come to pass, basically it's either they quietly sit there and collapse while telling everybody else that they escalate, they make the war kinetic.
Be interesting to see what happens. last thing I'm
so yeah, I think that in the US will probably suck a little bit, right? Not nearly as much as it would suck in Europe. Mm-hmm. At least the Eastern Europeans, or especially the Bulgarians, are having no illusions about what's coming this winter.
Yeah. Okay, which of these articles did you have an affinity for? Lifestyle, not age rules, cognitive function. I thought that was interesting.
Which one?
Lifestyle, not age, rules cognitive function, and negative childhood experiences accelerate aging, disease in human.
Yeah. I mean, both of these are something that we've discussed many times, but now, and medicine has been denying. They've been saying, well, if stress ages you, it's because you're genetically susceptible. If you have a negative childhood experience, some people are resilient. They don't get depressed. They don't get, they don't become... They don't develop mental disease. They don't develop Alzheimer's later in age, right? So they kept trying to say that it's all in your genes. But now more and more studies are coming out saying that basically, like if you look at the metabolome and the methylation pattern of the DNA, there is a big difference regardless of what your genetic makeup is. And basically there's no denying. And some of those studies started back in the 1950s by looking at Holocaust survivors, or maybe we shouldn't say Holocaust because it's a loaded word, but survivors of World War II and people who've been to camps have been wartime prisoners. Their children and their grandchildren and so on. So up to four generations later, there's been a dramatic uptick in the rates of chronic disease in these people, but especially mental disease, cardiovascular disease, and cancer, which are known, which we know, but now medicine is starting to admit, are directly causable by stress. And, you know, basically these studies are now coming out and saying, yes, actually, it all starts in the childhood. These things are, there's a causal relationship now. It's not about your genes. You know, maybe your genes can help you resist a little bit, but if this continues long enough, then even your genes are not going to be able to help you.
Was it Barbara McClintock that thought the genetic material was like an organ and that it could be reconfigured in different ways based on the person's environment?
Well, I mean, that's the whole idea of the Lamarckian evolution, right? Mm-hmm. What's the point of being alive if everything about your life is already predetermined? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point? Mm-hmm. Some people say, well, so that, you know, every 10,000 years or so, one of us randomly gets a random mutation in their code. Well, you don't need that many organisms. You don't need all of this waste, this pointless existence, if it can happen on a random basis. So it's deeply contradictory, this whole idea of random evolution and random mutations. It's very contradictory because, you know, if it's all about if there's no waste in nature, right, then nature would have been able to do all of these things if everything was random by expending a lot fewer resources than it currently does. But again, it seems that Lamarck is a lot more right than actually, I don't know. They're trying to say that Darwin was actually anti-Lamarck, but that's not true. If you look at Darwin and when he wrote his theory of evolution, he was very much in the same school as Lamarck. Somehow he got appropriated by certain circles in science, probably paid for by the Rothschilds. And I don't know if the Rockefellers were already around at the time, but you know, somebody usurped these ideas and then infused them with some hardcore, like, religious that ideas that basically it's all preordained, right? There are certain chosen people and everybody else is a slave. And that's really what the modern evolutionary dogma, they call it the central dogma of biology, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That basically everything flows from genes to protein, not the other way around. And everything is random. You know, it's all bad luck or good luck. There's nothing you can do in your life that actually can change your fate, right? Or the destiny of you or your progeny. But I don't know. I think it's, to me, it sounds like even though it may not, one single lifetime may not be enough to cause a mutation, a change in the genome, we now know there's actually horizontal gene transfer. And we now know that basically by eating specific foods, we actually the body selectively decides. And we don't know when and how exactly it decides, but it selectively decides to incorporate certain genes. And that's the idea of horizontal gene transfer. What was the name of that lady? May Wen Ho who wrote about more about horizontal gene transfer. She was a big champion of it, right? Science kept claiming, oh, it happens. First, it said it cannot happen. Then they said it happens, but only certain species. Then they said, okay, it happens in all species, but it's very, very rare. And now it turns out that it's not rare. And basically, when eating a certain food, I forgot the paper, but I'll try to find it and forward to you. I think they said you have between 2-7% chance every time you eat a food to actually incorporate genetic material from the food.
Last question on this. If the whole idea of genetic determinism is not right, how do you explain family inheritance or heredity?
Just because something is hereditary doesn't mean it's genetic. There are several experiments recently done with mice, and I think they're trying to explain it with methylation of genes, right? I think there's something more than that. It's not just the methylation, because it's still the word epigenetic still implies the genes are primary, and it's only like these methyl groups that are silencing certain genes, or the lack of the methyl groups is activating a certain gene. I don't think it's that's the whole picture. But anyways, the study showed that if you expose the mother, pregnant mice that were exposed to cat urine. And they knew that this is basically the urine of a predator. their offspring, when they were exposed to cat urine, they basically exhibited a fear response, a stress response. And there was no way for this to happen because there's no gene that could have changed so quickly in the mother. And by the way, they actually looked at the genome. Nothing changed in the pregnant mothers. So somehow the mother was able to imprint the fear of a predator that the offspring had never seen, right? And was already wary of and knew to avoid. And they try to explain it by these methylation patterns in the genome. But I think one of the study actually looked at the methylation patterns and didn't find them that much different. So something else is going on. I think there's somehow the offspring, maybe Luc Montagnier was right. Maybe basically the way the genome imprints itself is electromagnetically, and it can actually do that, or at least the activity, the current activity of the genome and metabolome and the proteome, the current state of the organism can project itself and literally imprint itself on nearby other nearby organisms. And the way Luc Montagnier demonstrated that, you can, if you have like two flasks, one of them containing DNA material and the other one containing pure water, right? He basically showed that if you keep these close enough, even though they're completely hermetically sealed, if you keep these close enough and if you bathe them in the so-called Schumann resonance, which is something that the Earth produces, then after a while, the flask that contains nothing but water, you can actually get, I think if you put a small amount of genetic material and then pass it through the enzyme DNA polymerase, you can actually reconstruct the DNA that was in the original flask. So maybe there is an electromagnetic component to this whole hereditary inheritance thing. And I think it's several stories that corroborate this is that, I think I've mentioned this before, that nurses that work like in the specific wards in a hospital for long periods of time eventually end up with the same diseases as the patients that they were treating. So there's something in there. I mean, some people say, well, maybe it's chemical signals. Whatever it is, it's not genetic, right? So if we are capable of basically catching trauma or disease from other people, and if it's disease that's not actually transmissible, then it will be a lot more, it will be a lot easier to accept that the mother can actually transfer memory and like in general, its memory of its lifetime to the offspring, or at least imprinted with certain basic things that happen to the parent. To me, it would be a lot easier to accept. I don't think that the genome is an answer. We already know it's not because they've looked at it and it's not changing. And I don't think the epigenetic thing, which is just, I think it's a trick the geneticists invented to stay in business. Because they said, well, it's still the genome, but it's the activation and deactivation. I don't think that's true either. It plays a role, but it's probably not a major role. I think there is another component. And if I had to guess, it has something to do with electromagnetic fields and the ability of one organism to influence another through that.
I just had the paper from Georgi Saba. So that was one of the dudes that did a lot of stuff on hormonal imprinting. Okay, great stuff there. Let's talk about, do you want to cover these vitamin D ones real fast? So vitamin D and high, not low PTH predict bone deterioration, and then vitamin D likely effective as an antidepressant.
So I think the first one is very important because I don't know if you know, but one of the clinically, the current mainstream therapies for deteriorating bone health is actually injecting people with parathyroid hormone. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes they give a vitamin D. I've always wondered, like, okay, so clinicians know that vitamin D lowers PTH, right? Why would you inject them with PTH and vitamin D? These things are working against each other, right? Then if one of them is good for the bone, the other one cannot possibly be. Isn't that obvious, right? But anyways, to this day, this is actually, you know, established therapy for osteoporosis, osteopenia, for radiation-induced osteonecrosis. All of these things, basically, the currently approved therapy in most Western countries, and I think not just Western, but just the current state-of-the-art therapy for deteriorating bone health is to give you an injection of parathyroid hormone. And I think that is actually the only approved therapy. The others are adjuvants. You know, some doctors may give you vitamin D. Some other doctors may tell you to eat more calcium. But the one actually drug-approved therapy, the one approved therapy that is based on a drug is a patented version of the parathyroid hormone, synthetic one, and you're getting it injected. But this study now showed that actually the two most reliable predictors of deteriorating bone health is low vitamin D levels, specifically 25-hydroxy D3. If it's below, I think, 20 nanograms per deciliter, that's the cutoff that really predicted very poor, very soon, like an impending rapid deterioration of bone health. And then the other variable that was very highly predictive was PTH levels above 44. And I think they're saying that in 44 is basically close to the upper limit of the normal range. So again, I mean, just as I said, the start is, if these two things work in a direction opposite of each other, they cannot both be good for the bone. And this study is now showing that they're not. In fact, you want one of them low and the other one high. And the one you want low is parathyroid hormone, because parathyroid hormone, as the study actually says, is involved in increasing bone resorption. How? By raising prolactin and raising serotonin. And if you raise serotonin, you also raise cortisol. All of these, each one of these three things and all of them three combined are highly catabolic for the bone. People with high cortisol have high serum calcium. People with high prolactin have high serum calcium. People with high parathyroid hormone have high serum calcium. And the way they all work together to basically raise serum calcium when dietary calcium is insufficient. So I have no way of explaining who and by what logic approved PTH as treatment for bone health. But this is the only study that I've seen so far that actually says that high levels of PTH are bad for the bone. And in fact, a highly reliable predictor of impending rapid deterioration of bone density anywhere in the body. I think that they looked at spinal bone density, bone density in the extremities, bone density in the chest cage. Basically, anywhere you have a bone, they showed that PTH was a reliable predictor of that bone area thinning.
I see higher than 44 all the time, 50s, 60s, 70s, extremely common. And I even see it when the vitamin D level will be fairly good. It will be around 50 or 60 or so, and it can still be pretty high. And so getting the calcium in, I think, is the other thing that really powerfully suppresses it. So what marker are they looking at when they're giving PTH to somebody and then they're saying, oh, it's increasing bone density? Like, what are they... How are they even concluding that? They're looking at the serum calcium?
Well, they're actually doing the bone density scans, the x-ray ones, mm-hmm, right? They'll inject you with PTH for a while, and then they'll repeat the scans like every few months. I think now there's a push to actually look at osteoclasts and osteoblasts in your bloodstream, mm-hmm, which are basically like the anabolic and the catabolic bone cells. Mm-hmm. And you want basically like anything that inhibits the osteoclasts but it increases the osteoblast is good for the bone. PTH is actually known to increase both, just like estrogen. Mm-hmm. I guess they decided that PTH is good for the bone because they looked at what it does to these two types of cells, and they saw that it increases both. Mm-hmm. And somebody decided that if it's increasing the turnover of both types of cells, then this is good for the bone because estrogen does the exact same thing. But over time, both estrogen and PTH favor the osteoclasts, which basically destroy the bone. Even though the study doesn't directly say that, the fact that it found that PTH is such a reliable, high PTH is such a reliable predictor of deteriorating bone density, to me basically confirms that, that what was found for estrogen that eventually starts to favor the osteoclast is probably true of PTH as well. And how can it be any different considering that PTH will raise prolactin and prolactin will raise estrogen? And by the way, prolactin directly favors the osteoclasts. It's a molting hormone, and high prolactin is known to lead to hypercalcemia. Not to the levels that people with advanced cancer will have, but the reason people with advanced cancer have hypercalcemia is because they produce something very similar to PTH. It's called PTHRP, which is very similarly looking peptide, and it has the exact same function, but it's much more aggressive, much more potent than PTH. So it's called PTH-related peptide, PTHRP. And it does the exact same thing. It melts the bone and dumps the calcium into the bone.
So this must be a situation where, like, one, the estrogen myth lies under the PTH myth, which lies under this here, like on top really of serotonin of and you nitric oxide. Like
the, one of the one, yeah, you pull one of the fundamentals, and the whole thing collapses. Yeah.
Okay, let's do a little bit of an advertisement here. How do I normally do these? I don't even remember. Okay, IdealLabsDC.com. This is your boutique supplement company. And so is there anything that you would like to update us about with this, Georgie?
I don't know. I mean, I guess we probably, we may release soon the other serotonin antagonist, the synanserine. I think I've mentioned it a few times, but we finally have a sufficient amount synthesized. So it's similar in its pharmacological profile to cyproheptadine. But unlike cyproheptadine, it doesn't seem to have any activity on the histamine receptors, which a lot of people would seem to prefer because it avoids the excessive sleepiness. It still has a calming effect. Many people don't know, but serotonin antagonists, especially of the ergot class, used to be used as an anti-insomnia agents back in the 60s and 70s. So anything that opposes serotonin will actually make you relaxed and potentially sleepy, but not drowsy the way the kissers would. So that's one thing. What else? I mean, we're doing more and more of the steroid analysis in nail and hair girls as well. There will be a official project sponsored by the European Union that the lab that I established in Bulgaria is now participating in. It's called Test My Stress. If you search for that, especially on Bulgarian language websites, you'll see the project. It's funded by the EU, but we're participating as an independent lab. We'll do the testing. It's essentially 100 to 200 volunteers. And basically the it's a bunch of psychiatrists in Bulgaria trying to determine that's the first thing. Somenso. So that if you check that video out, and I'll send you another two videos with the lead scientist that I'm working with in Bulgaria. He's the guy performing all the analysis. Him and a few other a few of his students, so psychiatrists in Bulgaria have started to realize that there's a neuroendocrine aspect of most mental diseases, especially of stress. And stress is driving many of them, right? So they're basically now trying to get all of these volunteers, and they're going to put them through all of these questionnaires for stress. But they also want to see how the various mental diseases that these people have developed, how they correlate with several hormones. So we're going to be analyzing nails and hair from all of these volunteers for things like cortisol, DHEA, DHEA sulfate, aldosterone, estrogens, androgens. And then basically we're hoping to show a correlation, right, between several of these hormones and, you know, some of the pathological mental states. We're doing this strictly for visibility and for legitimizing the activity, because as it turns out, you know, an independently funded activity is frowned upon even in poor country like Bulgaria. The people that I work with, they're all established scientists. They all have teaching positions at the universities in Bulgaria. And when we got this equipment for doing the testing, then basically a lot of questions started being asked by other people at these universities, like, well, who is this crazy person that is paying all this money and hiring all these people to do things out of pure love of science? That's impossible. There must be a scam here. So there was a risk for basically the people doing all this work getting kicked out because the universities didn't like this unless it was somehow beneficial to them. The whole thing was, how does this help the university? Well, it pays the salary of these people that normally would be unemployed, because you guys are not paying us any salaries. The university said it's not enough. There has to be something for us. So we applied for this project, and, you know, that's the legitimizing aspect of it, is that it's giving exposure to the university and the scientists working. They're all university, staff. It's giving them exposure, and university's happy. Basically, university is being discussed on Bloomberg and several other, business channels. So the activity is growing, and we're getting more and more interest by regular doctors. They're saying, I've been, especially rheumatologists and endocrinologists, they're saying, well, I've been sending all of these patients to do like blood tests every month. You know, if you can show me that, you know, that it's better to do a test for cortisol in nails, let's say twice a year or even once a year, instead of sending them every month. And if you show me that it's a much more reliable result, then you know what? You know, let's publish something, or, you know, let's change the way the testing is being done, which kind of sounds ominous. I'm trying to stay away from officially changing the way the system works, because invariably you're going to upset somebody, especially the big labs doing the blood testing in Bulgaria. They're, you know, the European equivalents of LabCorp and Quest. They will not be very happy because that's their bread and butter. And suddenly a dilettante like me shows up and tries to muscle them out by saying, wow, we have a much better method and cheaper than you know, measuring all of these things and actually helping people because the tests are more reliable. I don't think it's going to fly very well. You know, maybe that's why the WEF and all these people are checking out my profile there. Somebody has officially complained.
Yeah, Georgie is not suicidal and neither am I. So everything happened. You're a big
do you have a LinkedIn profile?
No, I do not.
That's good.
Yeah,
good.
You're a big timer now, Georgie. You're going places. So that's amazing.
How about I don't go places? I prefer my life quiet and boring.
Yeah. Is there a popular river in Washington that people...
Potomac.
Okay. Okay. We'll move on here. So I do coaching on patreon.com/Danny Roddy. And then, okay, so I skipped an article here. Vitamin D likely effective as an antidepressant.
Oh, yeah. That's the biggest, apparently, I mean, that's what they claim, the authors claim. It's the biggest meta study to date that looked at vitamin D as monotherapy. Now, there have been quite a few articles saying, hey, vitamin D may have an antidepressant effect, but it's never been separated from the actual other drugs that it was co-administered with. It was always used as an add-on therapy, right? And I think this study was the first one that actually looked at only trials that used vitamin D, not specifically for depression. These people took it for other reasons, but they were evaluated for depression, right? And the ones that got diagnosed with clinical depression, mild or severe, vitamin D was actually very, very effective if consumed in doses above 2,000 international IUs daily. Mm-hmm. And that's not a very high dose. I think that's what, didn't Ray say that, you know, he would, if he was, you know, for him, it would be a good protocol to take 2,000 to 3,000 international units daily, especially if somebody's not getting good exposure to the sun or is hypothyroid. And then in the winter, he would up that to like 5,000.
I recall something similar to that.
Yeah. So, you know, and even though the study doesn't present a mechanism of action, my personal opinion, aside from the fact that vitamin D acts as a thyroid mimetic, I think another major mechanism may be that vitamin D actually turns out to be a pretty potent blocker of the cortisol signaling. And there are already several clinical studies with humans showing that cortisol blockers such as RU486 can cure depression rapidly in a matter of 24 hours. If you go to Google and type RU486 rapid antidepressant, you'll get several studies showing that you can basically rapidly ameliorate even suicidal depression by taking a few hundred milligrams of mifepristone, also known as RU486.
And then aldosterone is also involved.
Yeah, there we go. It's the second link.
Oh, yeah.
Abortion drug could rapidly treat depression.
I think our connection is going to deteriorate. Okay, we're all good. I mean, vitamin D opposes so many things. Cortisol, obviously parathyroid
estrogen.
Hormone, estrogen, yep. Aldosterone, and those are repeatedly.
Prolactin,
and those are all, you could type in any of those in depression and find them elevated in certain situations.
Serotonin, also. Vitamin D, one of my first posts on the Rapid forum was that vitamin D is an inhibitor of the enzyme tryptophan hydroxylase. And basically now inhibitors of tryptophan hydroxylase are being tested for obesity, diabetes, and whatnot. And there's a small clinical trial for treatment for depression. Now, if that succeeds, I really don't know how big pharma will be able to continue its homicidal industry of selling SSRI drugs. But I'm sure they'll find a way. I don't know if you saw the news. I'll send you the article. But basically, the article was like, you saw that. Did you guys see the news about serotonin low serotonin not being a cause of depression? Yeah. Well, guess what? It's not gonna make even a dent in big pharma sales of SSRI drugs.
We forgot.
Yeah, they'll find a way.
We forgot anti-adrenaline. And then also, I think vitamin D is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. And so,
yes. So basically a thyroid mimetic. But, you know, some of those pathways are, you know, they're definitely known to impact depression very, very strongly. Specifically, I think the blockade of cortisol and the inhibition of serotonin synthesis, these two together are probably pretty high up there in terms of, you know, effectiveness as antidepressants.
Great stuff. Did we cover these accurately? We did talk about both of these, right? Am I crazy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in the past, I think the past show.
Okay. Okay, let's jump to one of these other ones. Which one did you want to chat about? I guess serotonin works. We're already at like an hour, so we could probably wrap things up fairly soon.
I mean, I like this one because it's a recent study, and it's one of the few. First of all, it's published in Nature. Anything that gets published in Nature, usually people take notice. Mm-hmm. Very few studies in Nature that I've seen, maybe like no more than five, I can count them on one hand, that actually bash serotonin. And this is one of them. It really depends whether you consider bashing or not, depends on your viewpoint, but it basically said that elevating serotonin, and not just elevating serotonin, but elevating by administering an SSRI drug, made people basically blunted and if completely eliminated their response, their learning response to positive reinforcement, which is, in other words, with a reward, while simultaneously drastically increasing their sensitivity to negative reinforcement learning, which is through punishment and or fear. And I immediately remembered like the studies with LSD back in like the 60s, where they basically like they'll give the soldiers LSD, and like these people that are they're accustomed to function in a highly hierarchical environment. They follow orders. They march in these impeccable lines, right? As soon as they gave them LSD, stopped following orders, they started marching in completely disorganized fashion. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were rolling on the ground, laughing, right? And I'm sure at that point, the government knew, no matter what we do, we have to find a way to promote serotonin.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I think, you know, there's the expression, don't ascribe to malice what can be explained by stupidity. Mm-hmm. It's way too much of a coincidence that the SSRI drugs, and specifically the study used an SSRI drug to promote this behavior. I mean, this is the behavior that every government in the world would love to have from its citizens. Basically, you know, not respond to positivity, but to negativity. And that's what the government does. It's mostly an instrument of terror, of control. And SSRI drugs apparently mimic very well, or at least prime people, to listening to the government and behaving in a way that the government wants, even if it's detrimental to them.
It was on the Right Peep forum, and you had posted something pretty interesting about behavior. Maybe it was psychopathy or narcissism or something. Do you recall what I'm talking about? It was fairly recent.
About horses. It promotes servility, obedience, and basically destroys creativity. And it made the horses learn by being beaten versus mm-hmm. them, you know, being given a food reward.
I wonder if that was it. I wish I had wrote it down, but you were having some back and forth with people and it was you were saying some pretty interesting stuff, but I think it was surrounding behavior and the hormones interrelationship with the type of behavior a person would express. Okay. Let's do.
Oh yeah. Somebody asked like, what's the, somebody was asking what are the signs of, yes. Not psychopathology, but like low brain energy.
Yes, yeah.
And I was saying like aggression, inability to acknowledge, register, or even basically recognize novelty, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Like fearfulness, a preference for highly hierarchical structures, mm-hmm. All of these things, essentially things that, so anything, I think it comes down to novelty. Basically, serotonin destroys your ability to recognize or even see the usefulness of novelty. It makes you highly averse to it. Mm-hmm. So anything that challenges you in any way, if serotonin is high, which means brain energy will be low, you'll make you react in a very, very hostile fashion. And it just happens to be what the military loves, right? Anything that is not explicitly permitted is forbidden.
Great stuff. Okay, let's jump into one more here. Do you want to do the endotoxin or the aspirin or the breaking seminal study core amyloid Alzheimer? fake?
Oh, well, I mean, that's, that one and the fact that the depression, did we talk about the depression one? That basically this big study by this, she's a very famous depression researcher out of the UK, very mm-hmm. highly respected. Mm-hmm. And I would say pretty much a pharma agent. But even she, that's the study that she published, a few weeks ago, saying that, the whole hypothesis of low serotonin being the cause of depression, it's finished. She basically said she reviewed all the evidence. She found no evidence to back it up. She basically said all of the claims relied on each other, referenced each other. But when she started teasing them apart, eventually found nothing except one small association study, I think from the 80s or something, mm-hmm. just before Prozac was released. Mm-hmm. And she basically said, contrary to that, there are multiple lines of evidence showing directly that serotonin is a cause of depression. And of course, the mainstream press didn't say anything about that. All they said is that, oh yeah, this hypothesis, serotonin, maybe low serotonin, maybe the cause of depression. Guess what? It's complicated. She didn't get it. She said, there's a very strong evidence for it. I'll give an even stronger evidence for that. Go to Google and type serotonin antagonists. You'll get a page in Wikipedia which lists pretty much all of them that are known to science, right? Click on every single one that has a Wikipedia page. If the first, if not the second sentence will say that in animal and human models, this drug has strong antidepressant effects. So if every single serotonin, if this most of the serotonin antagonists known to science cure depression, what does that tell you? Do you need any more evidence that serotonin is actually the cause of depression?
I feel like it's kind of like a cultural thing. Anybody who's clued in, understands that those SSRIs don't work, or that they make people feel worse over the long term, or they make them feel very numb. And so, I see what you're saying.
Right. But I'm saying so big pharma can wiggle its way around, they wiggle its way out of this by saying well, it's complicated. Maybe for some people it's high serotonin, for others it's low.
Yeah.
But if you have
no
evidence that low serotonin causes depression, and if you have evidence that every single serotonin antagonist tried for depression cured or alleviated it, that doesn't leave very much room for arguing. It makes a very strong argument for arguing that serotonin is the cause of depression.
Yeah.
Not that it's complicated, not that it's high, low, or some kind of a combination. And conversely, there are actually several serotonin agonists that got withdrawn from the market, first for killing some people. Remember, what was that, Zilnorm? The 5-HT4 agonist for GI distress, mm-hmm. for GI conditions. Mm-hmm. Actually, the reason it got withdrawn from the market wasn't because it killed a few people out of, due to gastrointestinal bleeding. Mm-hmm. It killed more people due to suicide. Mm-hmm. It made people suicidal. Mm-hmm. So if suicide is the extreme form of depression, or at least the extreme manifestation of depression, so there you go. You have the complete cycle of evidence. You have basically this latest now conclusive study saying no evidence that low serotonin actually causes depression. You have evidence showing that serotonin agonists cause depression, right? And you have evidence that serotonin antagonists cure depression. I think they should convene the Nuremberg trials. I mean, the equivalent of the Nuremberg trials in big pharma. Anybody sues, I think that would be, if there are any lawyers out there listening to this right now, you can make a lot of money by suing, because the evidence is overwhelming. If you care to look for it, it's there. You just have to collect it.
All right, my connection's really going to shit here. You keep cutting out, but we'll persevere here. I'm sure you guys can understand what he's saying. So the last thing, what wasn't the mainstream take on that woman's research? Serotonin doesn't seem to be behind depression, but keep taking your SSRIs. They work somehow. Yep. We just don't know how.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, another big study specifically on SSRIs concluded that they're no better than placebo. Mm-hmm. And the only ones that worked, I think they singled out one or two, and I have a study about that on the forum, that the only antidepressants, the only drugs out of the SSRI class that truly work better than placebo turn out to be partial serotonin antagonists, mm-hmm. partial glucocorticoid antagonists, so they're blocking cortisol, they're blocking partially serotonin, mm-hmm. and also increase the synthesis of allopregnanolone in the brain. Mm-hmm. And by the way, allopregnanolone is already approved officially by the FDA as an antidepressant. So Big Pharma has been using these. And if you look at some of their later reincarnations of the SSRI class, they're becoming more and more serotonin antagonistic. Mm-hmm. So they're still inhibiting the reuptake of serotonin. But at the receptor level, I think the one of the latest ones, it wasn't flibanserin, but pimavanserin. If you type P-I-M-A-vanserin, if you look at that drug, it's actually our almost complete serotonin antagonist while still being an SSRI. So basically, Big Pharma gets to keep the SSRI hypothesis alive whilst actually selling you a serotonin blocker.
Pimavanserin acts as an inverse agonist and antagonist, the serotonin 5-HT2A receptors.
Yeah. But it's also an SSRI. So if, you know, the hypothesis is intact, Big Pharma can still sell you this drug, tell you with a straight face that it's an SSRI, serotonin is still good for depression. But if you point out that it's actually almost all of its actions are blocking serotonin at the receptor level, they'll probably say, well, you're insane, so like we need to treat you. And
Okay, with that, maybe some closing words from yourself, Georgie, after a month of our hiatus. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, there is hope, but it's outside of the system. I've realized that people that stay for too long in the Western world and never leave, they, you know, some of them are beyond salvation. If possible, get out of the system, even for a day or two. You know, if you haven't seen it from the outside, it'll be a life-changing experience. I have, right? So every time I see it, it's shocking, right? But at least it reminds me that there is something still out there that is not part of the system. And for those people, there is still hope, and the world can actually very easily move on if this system, pathological fascist system, would somehow disappear or let the world, leave the world alone. I know it won't. But it's, you know, the system tries to convince you that there is no alternative. TINA, T-I-N-A, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the case. There's an entire batch of bigger world out there. And the only way to see it is if you actually get out of the system, at least for a few days. So if possible, try to do it before it's too late. Because I suspect that we will see war before the end of this year. Or some kind of a collapse that will be, you know, used to implement full-on fascism. If you don't believe that it's already there.
The other thing is, somebody had mentioned a place like Mexico. Like, if the power was intermittently out here, I don't think that would change a lot of people's lives. Like, I think that already is happening.
They've learned to live without it. Same thing in Bulgaria. Actually, if you go to Bulgaria, you'll feel very much as if you're in Mexico.
But I've known multiple people that like didn't have hot water. Like it's that common. And so, yeah, it's going to be devastating for probably Americans I don't know what's going to happen here, but like for Americans, but a lot of the rest of the world would already know how that feels. Okay.
I would say the big cities. I mean, like I've been outside of the big cities in the States. I've been to West Virginia several times, or the southern parts, southwestern parts of Virginia. I can tell these people will survive. In fact, they're probably praying that the coastal cities collapse and disappear, because they're nothing but a drag on those people. They know how to survive. They've been doing it for a long time. Yes, many of them are on the government dole, right? They're getting, you know, checks from the government, but they're not dependent. You know, I know the media tries to present them as what do they call them? Not the untouchables, but the deplorables, right? Mm-hmm. They're actually much more capable of handling life than any city dweller that I've ever met in the United States.
With that, that is Generative Energy number 87. Georgie Dinkov, thank you so much for joining me today. Very happy you're back and safe. Okay, we'll be back. I don't know when. Well, Georgie and I will schedule another one. But guys, we have an amazing listenership. Really appreciate it. Substack. DannyRowdy.substack.com. I don't even know anymore. But I'll upload this episode very soon. Okay, guys. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Georgie. See you guys soon. And we have an amazing audience. Appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.